Welcome again to Food Conversation, Season 8. Before we begin, we cannot forget that we live and work in Sukapmakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Sukapmak people. Every day, it becomes clear that doing the best we can to resolve this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for all of us. Now, today, our guest is going to help us look at an issue that addresses an important aspect of food justice that applies all across the country. It's been known for a very long time that using your mind is a lot easier when you're adequately fed than when you're hungry. Many children in Canada go to school hungry, usually because their families are struggling to give them adequate food to fuel their brains. Today, our guest is Debbie Field, National Coordinator of the Coalition for Healthy School Food. Debbie's based in Toronto, and she's joined us today via Zoom to help us understand why school food programs play a critical role in the health, well-being, and education of children, and therefore the future. Welcome, Debbie, to Food Conversations.
Pleasure to be here. Look forward to our conversation.
And Zoom just eats up those kilometers between you and me, so it's like they don't even exist. Now, like many issues today, giving school kids access to proper nutrition is a good news, bad news story. So let's plunge in and start with a piece of good news, something you even called a watershed moment for this country. And that is that earlier this year, the federal government announced a contribution of $200 million a year for five successive years, a total of $1 billion, to help develop Canada's first national school food program. Now, there was a lengthy article in the CBC website outlining the program and how long it's been coming and the fact that it's really a revolutionary change. And I just want to quote one comment from a woman in Newfoundland, Labrador, Debbie Marshall, who's a very active volunteer and has been involved for about 20 years. And she said, if a child hasn't got a full belly, they're not going to be able to learn in school. And I thought that sort of summed up the issue pretty directly and pretty clearly. But why don't you talk about, it's been a long time coming, and what does it mean? What does this money mean for the work that you do?
Well, it means that after decades of Canada being an outlier, literally the only G7 country and one of the only OECD countries, and increasingly one of the only countries in the world that didn't understand the importance of school food. Now we finally joined with the rest of the world. And so that's great. It means that, you know, wonderful school food programs in your community and in every community across the country will have a little bit more money from the federal government. But more importantly, this is really about a long term. I actually have a great quote from Wob Kanu, the premier of Manitoba. When he signed, so the way this goes is the federal government is bringing money to the table, and then each province and territory and Indigenous leaders are going to sign agreements and get basically a transfer payment. So it's not bureaucratic. It's not going to cost a lot of money to give it out. It's just like literally, okay, here's some cash going.
Here's the check. Take
what
off.
You're doing already. And I think that's important. Maybe we'll get a chance to come back to what's new and exciting about this community-based approach to a school food program. But anyway, Wob Kanu, who really might be one of my most favorite people, said, this isn't so much even about feeding children each day now. This is one of the most, and I'm quoting, consequential public policy in history. So what we've done is we've taken really the long view here. Sweden is really the best example of this because the Swedes have been doing this for a very long time, for hundreds of years. But because they keep such good records, they were able to give us really long-term data on what it's all about for generations to come. So we now can say that Swedish children are taller, healthier, have lifetime higher incomes that are transferred into the next generation if they participate in a universal free school food program. Now, the $1 billion from the federal government is not enough money for what we need. And so we're just beginning a journey, but at least it gets us going on that journey, which is why it's such a big deal.
And I was aware of the funding variety, the plurality of funding sources that exists around school food programs all over the world. There's private funds, there's donations or contribution from families, there's governmental funding, there's all sorts of different varieties. Isn't it wonderful, though, that the power of history, that the fact that the Swedes, bless their collective heart, have been recording data on this subject, and that means you can go back and say, well, it's not dependent on the custom of the day or the initiatives of last week, the latest
Right.
news cycle. It's been there for a long, long time. So what does the process, how does the process work? Does a program coordinator, say a provincial program coordinator, send a nice form off to the federal government in Ottawa and say, we'd like
No. So that's the great news. I mean, there were a lot of options. The federal government could have done a direct funding arrangement like that. I mean, there were years ago when we used to talk about maybe Health Canada, because we were looking at how do you get around all the jurisdictional issues? Maybe Health Canada could directly fund each school. By this time, by the time we actually get to here in 2024, we have robust systems. And of course, have to do a big shout out to British Columbia, because British Columbia was the province that took us from the really underfunded years to a systemic growth. So 3 years ago, $214 million commitment over 3 years. About 69 million in that first year. And so it became the first province to say, okay, we're not going to just give little dribs and drabs, but we're going to try to give enough money that we can ratchet the whole system up.
Global funding, yes.
So we have, and then, after British Columbia's big commitment, Feeding Futures, we then got a very big commitment in actually Newfoundland and Labrador. And then Manitoba, and then most recently Nova Scotia. And actually, I need to go back in the history. It's true that British Columbia's was the biggest amount, but the most significant was actually PEI. 2 years before British Columbia, PEI, our smallest province, made our most radical commitment to a universal pay what you can lunch program for all the kids in PEI. So we've got this system that is growing. We've got provinces and territories and cities. The city of Toronto is a massive contributor to school food programs.
Yeah.
And you were talking about different models around the world. One of the best programs in the world, Japan's program, is funded by municipalities in partnership with their federal government, right? So there's no one model in the world. And we're designing our own model, which will also have a lot of good community-based aspects.
Now, you mentioned pay as you can, which presumably means sort of an indirect means test of some sort done
No,
fairly.
no, no means test. So it
Somebody
ha
says we can, and then they can. And if somebody says they
yeah,
can't, they can't.
yeah, no. So I mean, that's the other great thing about software, right? We have a whole new way of. I mean, I was involved in some early pay what you can programs in the city of Toronto as a parent activist, and in those years, Fern Avenue Public School would send home the menu, and would suggest that you contribute $36 by check per kid. You got a discount if you had two or three kids, and then if you couldn't afford, come talk to the principal, right? So that was not a good situation
No.
because there was way too much stigma. Now in the PEI model, Warren can contribute $5 a day, Debbie can contribute $1 a day, and our kids could eat together and nobody would know the difference.
So it's a personal initiative on the part of the family of the person who's. They just say, this is what we can afford. That's it.
And
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to do a lot of research because the last before we are sure about all aspects of the pay what you can model, a lot of anti-poverty activists correctly or who are members of our coalition are quite worried about it. What they don't
For
want is
sure.
another burden on a low-income family.
For
So, but
sure.
I'm confident we can do this.
And people won't be so proud that they insist that, they'll pay the full thing. They'll be realistic and they'll know that it's not a black mark on their record if they contribute.
You have to do a lot of work at the school level and the cultural level.
Yes,
Because what we're
indeed.
trying, what we're trying to achieve here is the idea that everybody eats all day at school. Because you know what? If I mean you're a parent, I mean our kids, when they're 9 and certainly when they're 16, they want to eat 3, 4, 5 times a
They want to
day.
eat in their sleep if they can.
So we gotta, it's not, it's more than lunch. It's eventually some kind of grab as you go, breakfast
Sure.
and a snack program and a lunch.
Now, for listeners, I thought I'd mention the fact that on your website, the Coalition for Healthy School Food, there's a, I think it was, it's called a map, but it's really an infographic that is really detailed and gives a clear picture of where things are at and in a way where things are going. And just a few numbers off that illustration, 388 million children in upwards of 161 countries around the world, that is 83% of all countries, get some kind of subsidized school food. And that's the World Food Program talking about that. And pointing out that Canada's been a laggard up until now. But also, it gives an illustration of what's actually going on so far. And obviously, everything's going to be in flux right now because of this influx of funding from the federal government. But in 23-24, just over 50% of schools had a school food program. So that's a challenge right there. Half the schools, 48%, don't. And as of then, about a quarter of children were actually getting participating in one or more school food program. So that's the work project outlined there, as far as I would understand it. There's 75% who need to get involved in a program, and there has to be some funding spread around, as it will be from the money that the federal government has offered. That's sort of where it is right now.
I want to go back to actually your introduction, if I could.
Yeah.
And perhaps raise a question about the question of who's hungry for a variety of reasons. My own experience is that children of all income levels may end up hungry around 11 o'clock in the morning. And there are so many factors in that you can't even list them. There are children in your area of British Columbia who got up incredibly early, farm kids, kids who were bused, who really didn't feel like eating anything at all when breakfast was presented. There are kids in downtown Vancouver who are double income families, let's say a stockbroker and a lawyer whose kids are fighting with them about sugared cereal or whether they're going to get a new pair of sneakers, who reject what is given. There are kids of all income levels that are throwing their food away. And the other reason, I keep coming back to this concept of a universal school food program, and that's what we got from Sweden and Japan. That's where we get the big health impact. You know, I'm very excited, Warren, to speak with you as a doctor about this and what we could do to really, I mean, think about the $18 or $23 billion a year in chronic disease costs and what shifts in a world and in a country that feeds its children well from a young age. But the other reason I'm almost offended by the introduction is it makes an assumption about low-income parents, which is not my experience. As a child who grew up in a low-income house or having neighbors and friends who are themselves living on incredibly low incomes, my experience is that low-income parents, and particularly low-income women, will do anything they can to make sure their kid is fed. And that's a badge of honor for them. And they'll often not eat themselves.
For sure.
So I really think, and we're stuck in Canada because our policymakers have old language. They have a language of an old charity-based breakfast model that what we've got here are somehow low-income families who need being supported through this. And that is true that there, you know, are lots of reasons why money's really tight in families right now. So anything that helps a low-income and a middle-income family is a good idea. But what this is really about is our children are sick about food, and they have a variety of reasons to not eat well.
For sure.
Including billions of dollars of advertising that is convincing them to eat the wrong food.
Yep, all of that is true, and I take your point. It's a good point because there are a lot of different reasons why children don't get enough food, and they're not all. There's some that are structural, some are economic, but it's interesting. The rhetoric in support of food supplementation programs is often couched in this language that says, you know, there's a lot of people living below the poverty line who can't afford the necessities of life. And I think you're injecting a note of equity into this, but also a note of just the human experience that many people have, that they don't live in a world where the school structure, which is a very formal structure, but the idea that the only place that you learn anything is in a place where you hang out for many hours in a given day, 5 days a week, perhaps is an underlying element here in the discussion we're having right now, that there's this notion that learning has to be in a house that's on a hill where you don't go home until you've finished the process. And what school food program is doing is saying, okay, if you're going to have this slightly irrational form of education, then right, maybe you should have a slightly rational form of making sure that as the day goes on, the people who are participating, and I suppose that would even include teachers, you know, although they can bring, and if they eat with their students, you're creating another form of conviviality that enhances everybody's life.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also, I think through your farm analogy, you also brought up a great other concept here, which is how do we turn every single school into a mini urban farm? So, you know, clearly in your area, there are, you know, I would suspect acres of land around every school. But even in downtown Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver, there are opportunities to grow food around schools. And, you know, in Vancouver, yeah, you have some of the best examples, you know, of great not-for-profits that partner with schools and are growing vast amounts of food on school grounds. What happens to a child who lives in a school where food is grown and cooked and harvested and composted?
Oh dear, I'm just laughing because this is such a powerful learning tool. Yes. Growing up in a family where we had a large garden in our backyard, and I pulled the carrots out of the, you know, the garden and ate them right with all the dirt on them and lived to tell the tale and appreciated that experience. I just recently interviewed two families that have joined together to process, to grow pigs, and they process them on their land, and their children come out with them and they talk about these animals giving their lives so that we can eat. And yeah, they show them that they have to die, but that we do it respectfully and they are treated extremely well during their lives. And it's, you know, those children are going to grow up with a far more realistic view of what's going on in the world around them. And that's an education that probably has never happened in any Canadian school, that you'd grow animals and then you'd slaughter them on the school grounds. But that's realistic.
For sure. And you're raising what is one of the most exciting trends in school food in Canada, which are the Indigenous-led school food programs, because for a variety of reasons, Indigenous leaders have come to see a robust Indigenous food sovereignty concepts embedded in a school food program as a very important moment to healing of the residential school experience. Yes. Around food, and to making sure that country foods and traditional methods of hunting and fishing are brought back in. So in Haida Gwaii and many First Nations programs in BC and across the country, I mean, there's some amazing things happening in New Brunswick, in Nunavut. You know, there's seal being eaten and whale in school food programs in Northern Quebec, Inuit school food programs. So a very exciting moment to actually rethink, you know, so your images of the pigs, I mean, certainly chickens, I could see every school having chickens. Maybe every school does have a pig or a cow, but certainly a garden. You know, we're not sure about all this level, but I think a garden in every school and a kitchen in every school.
And you touched into an issue that I think is also really relevant when we're talking about school food programs, because there have been school food programs where all the food was in packages, it was commercially processed or highly processed, and the quality of the food was low, but there was food, and that was considered to be adequate. And you also mentioned about Indigenous food sovereignty, but the scientific evidence shows that when Indigenous communities go back to eating the way they ate before the settlers arrived, their across the board health parameters start to improve. So there's sure. All these win-win-win possibilities Absolutely. Looming large. And as you were correctly pointing out, well, this is a farming community. It used to be a logging and farming community, but the tree, they've cut so many trees down, it's not as much of a logging community as it used to be. But farming is coming on like gangbusters, local farming. And it doesn't take a lot of energy for people now to drive down the road and meet the farmer that is growing the food that they are eating, which is, again, a return to a different system after a nightmare of about 70 years when we thought we could buy fruit from Malaysia or Costa Rica or Mexico or Florida or New Zealand, and it was just the same food as we got next door from our neighbor. Again, scientific evidence is putting the lie to that particular myth.
Can I go back a second? Because you, there's two things you said that I think are really, really important. First is that there are some academics who have written about the stages of school food programs, and they've hypothesized that between 1850 and 1950, there was the welfare phase. So those programs who came on board in those times, including the United States and Britain, were very much dealing with a paradigm around feeding hungry families, and they came right. on with that. And in that concept, you don't really care about the quality of food because it's as an emergency intervention that you're doing. Yeah. Then we go through the 1990s. People begin sort of late 80s, beginning the 90s. They say, well, why don't we look at the quality of food? Why are we just serving anything mm-hmm. like you're saying? And that's sort of the second phase. And then now we are in the third phase. And the third phase is actually is looking at a more holistic concept of food systems. And that's everything you've just alluded to in terms of what we can then do and all the healing things that happen for a community when a school is a place of connection, right? So when you were talking about your farm, the farm community, right? Farmer visits to schools. I mean, there's some great stuff in Vermont where there's some, you know, organic farmers who spend the winter as the chef in the school. And so on, right? So there's a lot of good stuff that can happen. Yeah.
You know, as a child who used to go to the UBC farm, it's the only working farm within the city limits of Vancouver. We used to go to see the cows or to see the chickens. That was the tagline that said, we're off, right. we're going to see the cows. And just right. being in the presence of animals who were food animals, but at the time were live, healthy animals who would talk to us in their language. And we would respond, of course, as kids in ours. It makes you aware of the fact that there is no such thing as a package grown in Mother Nature. If they're packages, they're live packages, and they have their own way of looking at the world. And the more that is a trend that I think embedded in the trends you outlined, sort of charity leading to feeding programs. It really is also a change in the whole world food system, a global food system, which, as I said, had a bit of a nightmarish 3/4 century after Second World War. It's interesting that Cargill got its start by bringing North American food to Japan when the Americans hung around in Japan and forced my stepmother to drink milk when she'd never taken dairy at all and probably didn't have the enzyme to digest the milk sugar, and also to eat bread when they'd been eating not wheat but rice. And it was a huge sort of colonial intrusion, but it was done because it was the beginning of that system where large players distribute large quantities to large people, sort of a kind of dark outcome of the Marshall Plan. I don't know what the food was in the Marshall Plan, if there was food, but it probably wasn't as good as
There was canned, canned
spam,
right?
Good old spam.
And I don't think it's over, right? Like, I think I think it's worse in some ways. Mm-hmm. Again, we like to mock the American road trip where, all the food is bought at the gas station. But I think Canada, unfortunately, is coming fast onto that model. And though we have farmers markets and great capacity to grow fresh food, our dominant distribution system is dead packaged food.
Yes, indeed. The trucking system.
So creating all of our dreams for whole foods for our children, right? And it doesn't have to be fancy or expensive, right? But children, we often used to say that we've never met a child who didn't love a cherry tomato, even if it was never presented to them before. We've never met a child who wouldn't just pick it up and eat it, little berries and things like that.
For
And
sure.
there's some great things, the salad bar programs and the farmers market salad bar programs, where children have the illusion of choice in a great medley of all healthy options of vegetables cut up and protein of choice cut up. And so it doesn't have to be fancy or expensive, but creating the palate for healthy food when children are little, obviously you can see as a doctor what that would mean, the lifelong health patterns.
Well, I'll tell you something about doctors, which you already know anyway, and that is that in medical school, there is absolutely zero education around food. It may seem peculiar to listeners to hear that, although they've heard it from me before. And that is that the entity which holds itself up as the prime mover of healthcare in most countries, the doctor, is absolutely unequipped to deal with the kinds of issues we're talking about right now. And changing that is happening, and we'll talk about that in a little while, but it's a very slow process because when you go to medical school, that's where you learn what you think you need to know to be a doctor. And if you don't learn anything about food, then you think you don't need to know anything about food. And so it's all done postgraduate. You learn about the real world after you've left medical school. Now, I want to.
It's a bit of a diversion, but it's such a good story, and it is connected to school food. So,
Yes.
years ago, my primary care doctor was Dr. Jean Ramorio, and her partner was Dr. Carolyn Bennett, who was then went on to.
Yes, indeed, political life, yes.
And so, Carolyn, not so much, but Jean was infamous for making us wait hours for her.
Guilty as charged.
Which I love in retrospect. I can see it was beyond the 15-minute visit she actually wanted to hear from us, which was
For
great.
sure.
So anyway, I pitched Jean on this idea that they could serve cut up vegetables and fruits in the lobby of their office, which was on Dundas Street West in downtown Toronto, and there was a Druxy on the first floor. So I even suggested they could just order cut up trays of vegetables and fruit every morning from the Druxy and put it out. And Jean, kind of humored me, kind of liked it. So she let me meet with her colleagues, the management team, eight of them. And I came and I presented and I brought a tray. I worked at Food Chair Toronto at the time and we had the capacity to do it. So I brought a tray just to show them what I was talking about, carrot sticks. I kept saying, everybody's so calm. The kids would quiet down. Everything would be fine. I mean, this was before, SARS and COVID. So maybe we'd have to rethink some of it now. But anyway, who knows?
I
So
don't think
anyway,
so.
I'm glad. So I pitched it to them. And one doctor, first of all, they said, "Oh, we talk about food." And Jean said, When do you talk about food?" And then finally one doctor said, "Oh my God, first smoking and now this. What do they want us to do? Fix all the problems?"
Oh my good,
Anyway.
preventative health care. We can't do
Yeah.
that. We got to wait for people to get sick before we can do anything. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I've heard those lines. So what happened? Did they put it in?
Oh, of course not. No, but where it's relevant is to the school, right? There
Yeah.
are some incredible examples that we have from across the country of innovative principals who are figuring out how, a bowl of apples at the front desk, a bowl of apples in the front of a room. There's so many ways that we can do this in an inexpensive and safe way that will make the school function. Kids who are agitated or often agitated because they are low blood sugared for whatever reason. Maybe that's what we should say. Our website should say children come to school and are low blood sugared for a variety of reasons
Right.
rather than
And
hungry, right? So,
where
yeah.
the food, the blood sugar replenishment program, not the food,
Yes.
school food program.
I like it. I like
It's coming. It's coming.
It's got a ring. It's got a ring, yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about you getting into this kind of stuff because It became immediately obvious when we were talking earlier that, in fact, I think the first thing you said to me, I've been a lifelong advocate. And I said, okay, we're going to work on that. And so spend a little time paying attention to that. You were born and raised in New York, New York City.
I'm sorry. It didn't come up in our first. I was born and raised in Peoria, Illinois.
Moved. Yes, that's right. That's right. What? Could you say that there's something you remember from Peoria before you moved to the big city, the Big Apple?
We had a great mulberry tree in our backyard, and I loved it. I loved mulberries to this day. The idea of, because you can't bring, you can't bring mulberry to market, right? You can't sell a mulberry because it'll fall apart. So that's a great memory I have of Peoria.
Picking off the tree.
Yeah, sitting in the tree and, again, that little berry that you love so much.
There's a whole other set of species in the world that do that, and it's nice for a human to get back to our roots, as it were. Well, you moved to New York City, the big city, the Big Apple. Interesting that it's a food, that's the name of the subtitle of the city. And your mother was widowed quite early on.
My father died when I was three in Peoria, and that was one of the reasons my mother moved to New York, looking to have a little more stability in a bit of a family network. Or we didn't have family, but I'm a Holocaust survivor, and my whole family was killed in the war. But my mother had some cousins and a couple friends in New York, and felt that she'd get more support. And my mother worked minimum wage jobs, so I technically lived below the poverty line, and for that reason, I qualified for the free hot lunch program in Brooklyn in grade three, third
and
grade.
What do you remember about that? Because that's a very personal, introduction to a very large and abstruse topic.
Well, I remember a lot about it. I loved the food. I've always been a really big eater, and I love, so we had mashed potatoes, gravy, we had meatloaf and canned peas, because it was USDA surplus product, right? Because the US, we sort of got into that. We might get into that in terms of farm policy, because for them it was about two things. It wasn't just about feeding hungry kids. It was about creating a market for farmers in coming out of the depression. I had a lot of stigma in my program, because I would line up with my little girlfriend, whose parents could, quote, afford to pack her own lunch. And we would separate, and she would go into the cafeteria where you brought your lunch from home, and I would go into the free hot lunch program with all this, quote, low-income kids.
Isn't that remarkable? I mean, the idea that somehow kids don't notice, kids won't notice, and yet it was immediately obvious to you and probably to them, the ones who went with their packaged lunch. That must have been a dicey moment for everybody, for you.
It was difficult. The other thing about the story, which I often tell, is that my free lunch program in Brooklyn did not make my mother any less poor. Our yearly income did not change. So a school food program does not deal with the need for basic income and adequate minimum wage. That is a very important issue that we need to focus on.
So let's pause for 1 minute.
Sure.
Can we both say that we are in favor of a universal basic income?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, we can now proceed with the rest of the program.
As well as robust support programs, a basket of services. So Canada is really, again, behind in the world in social thinking on this category. The British talk about basic services. So the idea is what we need to create is a package or a basket of services. So subsidized housing, subsidized transit, free libraries, free healthcare, free education.
My Lord, what?
And adequate income. And none of these, we don't actually say to people, we'll give you more money so you can buy your healthcare of choice, though that is what's beginning to emerge in the system that is so dangerous. So yes, so we need a bunch of things. And a school food program like the one I had in Brooklyn didn't make my mother's income problems. It didn't get rid of them, but it did take a pressure off her. She often would say how comfortable she was that I had this great balanced hot lunch.
Yes.
It saved her that money. So there is some money that was saved. But it also changed what we ate for dinner. We would often have noodles and cottage cheese and butter for dinner because I'd already had meat in at lunch. So yes.
The other aspect of your life was that your mom was formally committed to being a communist. And if I can think of anything that would apply stigma to somebody living in the United States, it's being red, being communitarian and communist are so close together, and they're actually very similar in many ways as well. But the idea of having a parent who was known to be a communist, my Lord, what did that do to conversations?
She didn't ever talk about it, right? It took us many years. It wasn't until I was a young adult that I could even understand it. Like she hid it, of course. I mean, 1950s McCarthy era, it was not something I don't think I knew. When I was eating that lunch, I did not know. I knew my mother was, by the time I was nine, I already knew that she had a great sense of justice. But I knew nothing about her past political history, or that she served 3 years of a 5-year prison sentence in the former in Poland between the wars. But I didn't know any of that. So no, it wasn't in the mix when I was a child. It was hidden.
So how did that, even if you didn't know why she had a strong interest in social justice, how did that manifest in your life? How did you see your mother acting that affected you and caught your attention?
Well, years later, when the Vietnam War was being fought, she was one of the only parents I knew who would say she was against the war in Vietnam. So she had an understanding of being against war, though she wouldn't let me go to demonstrations. She was terrified. She forbid me. There was the big demonstrations I wanted to go to in Washington in 1968, and she would not let me go. She would say, "Oh, you're going to get arrested." And of course, I would say, "Oh, this is America. You don't get arrested at demos, right?" I mean, well, before and state and everything else that happened, right? So yeah, her social justice background has really influenced my own, for sure.
Did you have conversations with your mother? Did you know, like, we should care about this, and you'd say, well, okay, this is what I want to do, and like what you just described. But it was more than just the Vietnam War. It was also about other issues in the community itself.
Oh yes, because it was about I mean, I mentioned that my mother was a Holocaust survivor, so she wasn't in a concentration camp. But after she got out of prison, she had to go in hiding because people, we didn't have the news we have now. So people knew something was up in Germany. My grandfather, who they lived in that part of Poland, which is now the Ukraine, so this is all interesting watching the maps. Grandfather always said he would take his chances anytime with the Germans instead of the Russians, because there had never been pogroms that the Germans led. So anyway, her whole family was killed. She had to go, but she had to go into hiding. Her father understood that with a communist record, she had to get out. They knew Hitler was anti-communist. So yes, I grew up with fighting every day to think about a world that would not create that kind of massive destruction, which is why, as a Jew, I'm so horrified at current Israeli foreign policy and seeing what's happening in Gaza.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Feels impossible.
Some of the strongest resistance against current Israeli government policy comes from people who have experience with Holocaust, either survivors or descendants of survivors. They know that this is not a game. It's not a chessboard game. Did you at that point, this was after the war and the information about the Holocaust was coming out, and there was a general horror in among most of the allies about this. Did at that point any sort of issues around anti-Semitism come up? Or, I mean, you had your family, you had connections probably to the Jewish community in New York, but was that happening? That's when many of the organizations after the war sprang up in the United States, the second largest Jewish population in the world, almost as much as the Jewish population of Israel. Did that happen, or was that off the agenda at that point?
I think it was completely off the agenda because people were, reeling from trauma. You try to survive. That's the other thing that's so disturbing about the current situation in the Middle East, which is so similar to our own history in Canada. in terms of our own, you know, you started off our show talking about our own settler track record here. And, you know, I mean, I'm like you, I learn every week some horror that I did not know about in terms of our past. And one of the things about trauma and war is it doesn't go away easily. I grew up in the shadow of a terrible trauma. And I think it's only wise that all people who know about trauma want to protect everyone from that kind of trauma moving forward.
Now, when the Vietnam War came along, it really crystallized a lot of people's thinking about war, about what the national destiny of the United States should be, about peace versus war. As you describe it, you checked out Canada. Yeah. You said, okay, I'm not a draft dodger, but I am dodging the United States political scenario.
Exactly.
And you went to Trent. And how did you figure out Trent? Because they're, you know, at this point, the world's your oyster, or which means, of course,
or not, because I'm a child whose parents don't have any money. So my mother had since remarried my stepfather, but you know, they didn't have any money, so I couldn't afford anything.
You had $600 in your pocket.
Yeah, that was tuition at Trent. Yeah, so I went to my guidance counselor's office on a Monday morning, after a difficult weekend of thinking about all the problems politically in the United States. So I would have been 18. It's 1970, March 1970. And I said, I decided to move to Canada. And I was an ugly American who knew not how many provinces there were, that Ottawa was the capital. And
there's a few Canadians who don't know that either. So don't worry.
You know, what do you have in the way of Canada? And there was this big filing cabinet drawer, and these two files are hitting each other. And my guidance counselor said, there's McGill, but your marks aren't high enough. And then there's this Trent. It just came in the mail. I don't know anything about it. I would have gone to whatever that other file was. And I was lucky to go to Trent, which was, of course, a wonderful, small, very liberal arts, very progressive university in Peterborough, Ontario, and had great professors and met great people, and ended up staying my life in Canada, which was great news.
Now, before you left the United States, you left America a gift. And the gift was an act of activism when you were in school. And it has to do with pants, women, and the year 1968. So okay. I've set you up. Go for it.
Okay. Well, a couple of years before I went looking for university, I was attending high school. And by this time, we were living in the Bronx, not Brooklyn. So I attended something called the Bronx High School of Science, which was an interesting and great experience on lots of other levels. But there was a rule at the Bronx High School of Science in 1968, which is the girls were not allowed to wear pants to school. And I'm sure that was a rule that existed in many parts of Canada and the United States at that time. So some friends and I decided we would break that rule. We talked it over. There was very small of a group of us, only about 10. And so we
That's
decided.
Not we, That's not bad.
That was not bad. But it was, you know, we had 2,000, big high school.
0.1%.
So on Monday, we wore pants and we were sent home with a pink slip. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and on Friday, we broke the rule. And on the following Monday, I could wear pants to school. So it's always a good example. And I feel like it does bring us back to the Coalition for Healthy School Food and our own work. I mean, we started 10 years ago, a group of 28 of us. And today we are 340 member organizations, an additional 145 endorsers. And, you know, this idea that a grassroots movement that is committed and has a good sense of humor, is able to not get demoralized when things aren't going well, has been a real wonderful example of success.
Yes.
Many told us that we would never have a national school food program. Many told us that we would never see food literacy and local procurement and Indigenous control over school food programs. And yet these things are beginning to happen.
Yeah. So. On what you studied, and what the degree you got eventually was a degree in education. What was it about education that made you think, well, that's where I need to go? Where that's something that's important.
Well, I first studied sociology and English literature at Trent, and then I later got a master's in adult education from OISE at the University
of Toronto. Yeah.
So it was more adult education, right? How do groups of people learn and change, and how do so it comes back to that idea of social activism, and what is the theory of change that makes it possible to improve the world? So that's what is appealing, I think, about looking at adult education.
It was like formalizing the activism process. There's some rules to follow that work really well.
That's right.
Well, let's just talk briefly about another activism with Stelco, the Steel Company of Canada, and changing their employment practices. What did you do there?
You might remember a time when men and women did not make the same amount of money for the same job. That was
Really?
and so there was a movement called Equal Pay for Equal Work. So in I had been a community college teacher at Sheridan College, and through that I was a member of OPSU, the Ontario Public Sector Employees Union, and involved in what was called the Women's Caucus, because we were trying to get women's issues of pay and equality and other things. We were trying to get our union to be interested. So I ended up going and becoming the first equal opportunities coordinator for a union in Canada in 1978 at OPSU. And through that process, we began to notice that the problem wasn't so much the same job, a woman and a man not getting the same pay, but unequal jobs and unequal work. So,
Women couldn't do certain jobs.
yeah, so you'd have women who were cleaners and men who were caretakers making unequal pay. So it wasn't they weren't doing the same job. So it wasn't that level. So we had to get more sophisticated. And then the movement began to talk about equal pay for work of equal value. And that became a whole process. So we began to notice, of course, that there was a massive pay differential between blue collar men's jobs and white collar women's jobs. So a bunch of us decided to go get jobs in industry as a way of trying to take this.
You know, it's interesting because the legacy of Rosie the Riveter
Yes.
clearly had faded away. I mean, there was some the old, divide had crept back in. Anyway.
And then that Rosie the Riveter is very important because, in fact, during World War II, when men were more away fighting, a lot of jobs in industry were being held by women. So a guy named Cease Taylor, who was the president of the Steelworkers Local in Hamilton, his mom had worked in the coke oven. So he just did a very nice thing. He gave an interview in the Hamilton Spectator saying, "Hey, anybody want to take on the steel company? Come on down to the Union Hall. We'll help you." So they did. And we sued the Steel Company of Canada for a no woman hiring policy. When I applied for my job at Stelco in 1979, there were two drawers. You could see it. If you were a man, it went into one drawer, and if you were a woman, it went into the other drawer. So they were able, there was a young woman who had taken over the file at the Human Rights, Ontario Human Rights, and she was able to petition all this, and she was able to prove that in the month of February 1979, the Stelco hired 36 men who had no work experience, while not considering Debbie Field at all, who had some work. So we won our case, and I ended up working in the coke ovens at Stelco.
Fighting, yes, a wonderful employment opportunity, I'm sure, which you cherished ever since. But this kind of structural divide. I mean, these are structural issues. They may start in a conception in somebody's mind, but they become embedded in structures, and then the structures take on a life of their own. And when somebody looks hard at them, the structure just evaporates. It's got no meaning. It has no meaning in terms of human experience. And that's what you were basically pointing out. Now, we just maybe touch a little bit on what you did with to do with food, because for 30 years you were involved with food issues and very much a part of Food Share Toronto. How did that shape you moving on into the coalition? How did that, I mean, it seems to me a natural progression in some fashion, and then the advocacy stuff we've been talking about as well. But how did that lead you into eventually the Coalition for Healthy School Food?
Well, it actually was a simultaneous process. It was 25 years, and it was school food that brought me to Food Share. So a bunch of us. So after working at after being the first woman to work in the coke oven since World War II, and I then went and did a bunch of other jobs.
You didn't really want to stay in the coke ovens for the rest of your career.
I might have liked that, but there was a big strike, and all the women who had been hired were laid off in the way that happened. So our great victory was lasted only a year. All 180 of us disappeared from Stelco. So after another of bunch of other jobs, I ended up working for a guy named Dale Martin, who was a really brilliant metro city councillor. And he was the downtown ward mate of another brilliant person named Jack Layton. And
Heard
so
of him.
Jack, who was already married to Olivia Chow, was the city councillor, and Olivia Chow was the school trustee. And Olivia and Jack, and they tell the story, Olivia tells the story, you know, one Christmas Eve, the way they did things, they wrote this brilliant document, which I still have, that Jack tabled up to suggest that a universal school food program was needed in Toronto. Very visionary document from 1991. I ended up knowing and meeting people at Food Fair, many of them who were before my time already leading school food and a bunch of other things. And so I ended up running for city council and not getting elected. It was very sad to be defeated. And kind of
One of your rare defeats, Debbie.
oh no, one of my many defeats, and I didn't like
Yeah. A
very
visible
bad
one, though.
experience.
Yes, indeed.
So I ended up there was a job at Food Chair, and I ended up going there, and you know, by this time Jack and Olivia and I had begun the school food work, and it became an integral part. So in all the years at Food Chair, we innovated with my colleagues, fabulous, some of the best school food programs, as well as you know, the good food box and popular markets and good food markets and many things. So yeah, the Food Chair 25 years was fabulous. And while at Food Chair, I would have been one of the people at a founding meeting of the Coalition for Healthy School Food 10 years ago in Halifax. And so when I left Food Chair, I became the coordinator of the Coalition for Healthy School Food.
I'm sure you just moved from one office down the hall to another office in the same building, or almost like that. I mean, the in terms of the gestalt of where you were working, you were really
Exactly.
basically working as soon. Now, we're zooming towards the end of the show, but I just want to ask you a little question about. You live in the big city. You were born and raised, or you were raised anyway, in a big city south of the border. But when you put down things that you like doing, it's things like camping, canoeing, hiking, well, cooking. That's not surprising. But these are all outdoor activities that is not, they're not the thing that people move to Toronto for, but they are things that offer you a different perspective on life. Why don't you talk about that a little bit and how that why that's important to you.
Well, I mentioned that I went to Trent in 1970, and on the first day of classes, at coming out of one lecture theory, le lecture theater, there were four of us, and one of them was a guy named David Kraft. And he looked down at the river and he said, "Gosh, I wonder if they have canoes. Do you want to go on a canoe ride?" And so I met David, and I've had the pleasure of spending my life with David, and we have two great kids. And David has always loved outdoor activity, and so we early on went canoeing, and do we still do you know, we once had a little guiding company called Beautiful North Backcountry Travel, and we take people on canoe trip. So I've had the, and you know, that's really opened my eyes to a lot of Canada, because I've had the pleasure, I've you know, I've done the Mississinaba River, you know, and been and seen the how terrible the food is in Moose Factory, and you know, I've been to lots of parts of Canada canoeing and backpacking.
That seems to me a very sensible thing, and it's a great way to meet your future husband in a canoe. I think we need to have another show at some point down the road to talk about the interaction between health, human health, planetary health, and
Yes.
school food,
Yes.
and that kind of nexus, which I think is a really important one and needs to be focused on. It's starting to change. Because of my own proclivities, I'm aware of those changes taking place, but I think it's something that the fact that, for example, physicians are not trained in nutrition is embarrassing. It should be embarrassing to a lot of people, and it's starting to be that way. But the process of making that connection so that it's clear cut and crystal clear in people's minds is something that we need to maybe explore. So I'd like to thank you very much, Debbie, for being with us today. The Zoom facility is a wonderful thing. I can see the panels, the wood panels behind you in your old, how old is your house?
140 years, actually. It was built before 1885. We know that.
And the pine boards look just the way they did when they were first put up. Beautiful.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, we will talk again, and thank you again for being with us today. It's been a delight.
Thank you very much. Take care.